Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today is part one of five of my final conversation with Moog Sahu on why we have decided to wrap up this show.
Hi, welcome to Symptomatic Redness. This is the first part, or maybe the first of many parts of our final episode.
I like to call this the end. Oh, this is Derek, by the way, for those of you who aren't used to my voice.
And this is Moog. We're going down the beginning of a long final passage.
Yeah. So, you know, to talk about why this is the final episode and what prompted it, Moog, you got blindsided by this. I didn't actually tell you I was ending it till like I told everybody. I want to comfort our listeners who like our particular collaboration. You and I aren't done working together. It's just this project seems to have stalled. And why we talked about it later, why I think it stalled, has nothing to do with what you and I have to say, but everything to do with trying to be a political left podcast in the current milieu. Because there's so much content out there right now, it's actually very hard to make distinctive content and people listen to you.
Yes.
They kind of want their biases confirmed. And one of the most frustrating things to me is that everybody and their brother, be they a Marxist, Leninist, to left communist, somehow thinks I'm on their side.
Yes.
Which is frustrating.
So one hope that I have, at least for this final episode, is that some more clear position will be staked out. A clear position which will make it less easy for people to assimilate you to a number of what their particular pet project is.
And I want you to be able to stake your opinion more clearly because, for example, I've ribbed you a lot. You mentioned off mic a little while back that you were bothered by the couple of times I've said you didn't really count as a Marxist. Would you like to go into that a bit?
Yeah, sure. I think I'm no longer bothered by this. Maybe I'm bothered that I'm not bothered, but I think I'm... So there's a sort of biographical and an analytical element to this, as usual. So the analytical element to this is that while I don't disbelieve many of the things that I have learned on the left over the past sort of 5-6 years, a number of different things that, you know, were shown to me to be fallacious, from Keynesian economics, social democratic politics, et cetera, I definitely aren't. I'm not going back to those, and for broadly Marxist reasons. But it seems to me that the criticisms that I internalize never really seem to me to add up to a positive politics, even though they're very helpful in pointing out certain horrible dynamics in contemporary society, not very helpful in, you know, never really lived up to the promises of, you know, describing society as a totality and describing society in a way that would allow you to see its functioning transparently and intervene in it and all the sort of like promises of at least one variant of traditional Marxism.
And I think that's why you see so much of traditional Marxism being first Engelsianism, because Engels deals a lot more with politics. So that's why you see, you know, kind of Engelsian politics, which I don't think is separable from Marxism the way a lot of, like, say, Orthodox Marxist humanists and left comms do. But,
yes.
And then you
just
see...
Just a quick qualification, though. I mean, putting it in terms of not having a positive politics allows Marxists to hear that as, oh, we don't have a good, you know, class consciousness is low. And then they have a various like tactical and strategic solutions to the problem.
Yeah, which has worked
I'm
so
not
well
saying
for
that.
Them.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So the problem isn't as it were that, you know, the base is okay, but superstructure sucks. No, the problem is that the dynamics that we thought were the important social dynamics, you know, the dynamics which were the hinge around which social change turns, don't seem to me to have that place. And this is not to deny that they're not still going on. I think TLRPF and all that good stuff is still happening. I just think that it's no longer like the lever that allows us to intervene on society as a whole.
Yeah, for the newbies listening to the final episode, which would be unfortunate, TLRDF is the Tendency of the Rate of Profit to Fall. So let's start off here with some stuff you wanted to talk about. And what I've noticed is in the last 6 years, a kind of retreat to sort of orthodox Leninism of various varieties, whether it's Marxist-Leninism, Marxist-Leninism, Maoism, Marxist, you know, Leninism a la Trotskyism, although that seems to be fading. It was dominant for a long time. Some kind of neo-Kalskyist-Leninist perspective, Bakuninism. All these isms, right? They're all basically attempts to revive Leninist politics and to use the Soviet experience as kind of like a roadmap. And I find this to be a sign of alienation that just doesn't deal with, I don't know, the fact that, A, the Soviet experiment did fail, regardless of what you think the reason was.
And how laudable and important it was, blah, 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 blah.
Right, right. Like, I am like a mildly Soviet, mild Soviet defensist, although I would say very mild. Like, you know.
Yes.
Like, yes. I feel like, oh, it's worth defending that something was attempted. But all that said, so you see that reemerging. And in a sense, it speaks to the frustration people must have because it places the sphere of struggle out of the economic realm and back into the political one, whether people realize it or not. The idea becomes not, you know, the liberation of the workforce, but the counterparty. And what's fascinating to me that people just don't seem to see, and I don't have a coherent theory for this, but you can predict this turn to Leninism based off of whether or not you have a Republican or a Democratic president.
Right.
And maybe like my folk theory of that is that, you know, the Democratic presidents have some adjacence to socialism, not really. And so the sphere of political influence is more limited during those time periods. And when the, you know, when you're in pure opposition, it seems like all you need is the methods of power to take over. And you also see like this real sanguinity on the Chinese state emerge, which is bizarre. And a very like Manichaean, like, you know, we need to pick sides in international conflicts, even though most of the time that there is not really a good side to pick. And what fascinates me is the same people that hold these positions in one administration will flip and hold like various ones in another one, which tells me that there's something larger going on, but that we don't really understand what it is. And this is not totally about individual choice.
I mean, you pointed out a while ago that there was this flip, there was this kind of tendency to go between two bad extremes of economic and political determinism, right? You described the kind of, I think the tendency you described, you would class as kind of political determinism.
Right.
Right? But there's also a kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but the economic determinism aren't any better because the economic determinism either ends up being like anarchistic and eschatological too, which means you just wait for the general strike to happen, even though that never made sense.
Right. It's worthwhile to remind ourselves in this context that, you know, both economy and politics are kind of like bad carvings up of the phenomenon we initially cared about, which is our mode of production, right? Which is a social totality. It's this big, it's everything.
And there's been lots of discussions of the 40-year-old crisis of neoliberal capitalism, which is funny, right? Because neoliberal capitalism is basically 45 years old. So since before even Reagan, we were already talking about it failing. There's been a tendency, a la David Harvey and company, to see this as a political manifestation solely. Weirdly, actually, some non-Marxists are better about this. I think of Philip Murawski, who does seem to actually understand what was going on there more than most Marxists do, which is funny because he's not a Marxist.
And he's much more, I've since realized, much, much more scathing about Harvey. And he thinks, and this is a thesis we never really discussed, he thinks that neoliberalism is a series of conceptual tools to like eradicate the central concepts of Marxism. That like the neoliberal, everything from the neoliberal idea of labor as human capital and like all the sort of ideological machinery is designed to make our central concepts like fungible in their application to like contemporary society.
Right, it's, but where he's different is that he actually does see that there was that the Keynesian consensus of the 50s to the 70s really did fail.
Yes, yes. I mean, this is lovely debate on INET where, you know, there's this Keynesian response to his book, and he says, this lovely paragraph where he says, you know, basically he completely repudiates the Keynesian solution, just based with one sentence being like, you know, the problems in the 70s never really did go away.
Right. I mean, and what's been interesting to me is I've seen in the late Obama period, there is this tendency to even deny that there are problems in the 70s, which was fascinating.
Right.
Like, oh, it was just the oil crisis, and that was a political thing that caused stagflation to happen. And I was like, well, if you can't resist one cartel and one commodity crisis, then how strong is your fucking economic basis, right?
And that overlooks the fact that people weren't optimistic in the 70s. People on the left weren't optimistic in the 70s.
No, nobody was. I mean, read Ernst Mandel's Late Capitalism. Hell, they thought that everything was going to fall apart. And this has actually led us to SR. I mean, we could talk about the history of SR. Partly it comes out of a shit fight I had with Douglas Lane back when we were doing Pop the Left.
And on Pop the Left, a big discussion point was, you know, some sense of skepticism about the left, you know, either from T.J. Clark or from, like, Henry Flint, that guy you discussed, or I forget.
We discussed T.J. Clark, Henry Flint, Zerzan. You know what's funny about that, though, is what we were discussing was already kind of tendencies that were low-key dying at the time.
Right, right.
Like, anarcho-primitivism is not as major of a strain now as it was in 2011, and it was already dying from, like, its 90s heyday. In fact, like, some of the first episodes of that were really us fighting dragons that were dragons from, like, Doug's... you know, early adulthood in my teen years, you know,
right.
like the book Chin Bob Black fights and stuff like that. It's just not, some of it wasn't even relevant that much even then. A lot of it kind of was, but like we had debates on what historical materialism was, dialectical materialism, and where Doug is a dialectical materialist and I am a historical materialist, and people kind of miss that actually is a difference. We had debates on the nature of Zizek. We had debates on T.J. Clark. We had debates on a lot of stuff. And it kind of culminates in me going to the North Star and that failing and the Mark Fisher essay that ended all that off, which is probably the thing I'm most famous for, even though, like, people don't even mention the publication it was put in anymore, you know. In that time period, you asked me to come on like some YouTube show you were doing called Entitled Thoughts. It was originally called Entitled Opinions, but there was a podcast out of Stanford that had that name. I was living in Mexico at the time, finishing up the travesty that was North Star, and all my podcast endeavors had failed at this point. I was running a literary magazine and I still run this literary magazine, but I was running a literary magazine that at the time had a podcast associated with it. You know, and my co-host there is apolitical, but kind of leans conservative, and I wanted an outlet so people didn't just associate me with that. And you and I began talking, and we started off with Murawski, and we went through a bunch of, this was completely independent of Zero Books. I think the first 14 episodes, they went over the course of a year, but we had trouble finding a producer. I was too busy with like 85 different projects to keep it up. So it almost pod faded. And then Zero, Doug and I repaired our relationship, and Zero about a year later after that picked us up as a substring. Now,
right.
During all this time, the left milieu changed dramatically, because this is like leading, all this stuff is way before Trump, or at least 2 or 3 years before Trump. While I didn't call Trump's winning, I also was one of the few people that didn't think it was ludicrous that he could win.
Right.
Which is to say my political calculus is usually pretty on. I have a much better track record of calling elections than a lot of liberals do. But I couldn't quite call this one because I couldn't figure out what was going on in the Rust Belt. And I'll still defend that. But there also, I felt like there were no good takes either. There was some delusions about Bernie, and I still call them delusions. Bernie oscillates between being more and less radical depending on what he's up against. Yes. His 2016 campaign, he was a bigger outsider. He played in the beginning of this current campaign, he's played more of an insider until the last basically month, where he started really pushing some to the pretty far left of the post-Keynesian socialist contention. So that's an interesting right. change. But in the pre-2016 days, like, you know, you and I were predicting something like a clearinghouse of left sects, but we thought it was going to be, I don't know, the IWW. The idea that it would be the DSA.
Yes.
Because of Jacobin's relationship to Bernie, which is kind of, and Trump winning.
Yes.
Would have never occurred to us, because the DSA was such a limp organization for 30 years.
Right. I think it's useful to say, at least at the time, that it was really kind of supposed to be creatively ambiguous what the role of the clearinghouse was supposed to be, right? So some people would latch onto it. And this is, and the ambiguity was kind of justified by the Kautskyan, you know, programmatic rather than doctrinal unity kind of thought.
Yeah, although the very early on, you must admit, I wasn't a neo-Kautskyan.
No.
You know, like when we first started talking, that wasn't my take. I got kind of convinced by that, sort of,
right?
In 2015, because of the idea of a massive political clearinghouse, it kind of was a party, but not the party the way we think of parties now.
But I see that less as you being convinced of a view, and more that like neo-Kautskyism functions as a kind of like useful impulse in a time of disillusionment.
Right. But my critique of the current neo-Kautskyan project is that A, it's kind of just Leninism, and B, although McNair himself does have some pretty strong critiques of Lenin, but his disciples really kind of don't. I mean, actually, I want to caveat, I'm going to come down hard on Leninism today, but it's not that I'm an anti-Leninist. There's a whole lot of like knee-jerk anti-Leninism that I think has led to a lot of knee-jerk Leninism. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Oh, we don't like parties, we don't like leaders, except we don't like organizations, etc.
Which goes nowhere, which means that people who get sick of that immediately go to the thing that looks like it can deliver results. Right. You know, that's like almost every like Maoist or Marxist-Leninist, aka Stalinist, that I meet, like their argument's based on, well, this delivers results, you know, see the yes. third world, see whatever. But, you know, the immediate caveat that even like neoliberals have to that is like, yeah, for 5 years.
Yes.
You know, or in the case of the Soviet Union, for half a generation. So you got 15.
Yes.
I mean, you know, or you can go to China, but in China, you have to really ignore how far deviant things really have gotten.
Right. But to zoom out for a second to the pre-2016 left, so at least in 2014 and 2015, it didn't seem like the main conversations were tactical.
No.
Partly because no one had any chance of taking power even on the social democratic side. You know.
Yeah, but the funny thing about this now is no one does still.
Yes, like, but you know what I mean. It's more probable, I guess.
Yeah, but let's actually, like, it's not really more probable. I mean, like look, let's say that the absolute upper end number of the DSA is correct, and there's 60,000. My guess is 3/4 of the paper members.
And this
is from my experience of actually showing up to DSA meetings across the country. Yes. The chapters will be 400 people, and they'll have like.
And speaking 50. As a paper member, I can confirm that.
Right. Which I mean, that'd be true for any organization. Don't take it. It's not a strong critique to say that, but
no.
The idea of the sectarian clearinghouse is also it led to something I didn't foresee, which is like instead of left communism being the kind of knee-jerk response to that, to the problems of that, you see re-emergent Stalinism being a knee-jerk response to that.
Right.
I still don't know how much response it has, how real effect it has in the real world, except that when I like in Salt Lake, when I look at organizing, if it's not DSA and it's not like ran by an NGO effectively, it's mm-hmm. it is one of the like Marxite post-Trotskyist Stalinist groups like the PSL, or it's a Maoist group like the RFR, like Frizzo Fight Back. And you hear a lot of really naive takes on third world countries from people who clearly haven't really been outside the United States. That's a trend too.
Yes.
Where like people kind of really idealize these sort of alternate takes, and Senda think that American intervention is the only reason these things are getting so bad. But what's fascinating about this is that is even though supposedly there's a strong divide between the Social Democrats and the Stalinists and this stuff, their divide really is style. They actually believe a lot of the same shit about, you know, third world countries and developing countries. Actually, I don't have a good term for the kinds of countries we're talking about. Developing isn't really fair. Third world is really, it's a Cold War relic. It doesn't actually mean underdeveloped like people tend to use it.
It's literally the third world, which is neither
Soviet Union nor the Western capitalist axis. So we could say like the remnants of the third world, but it's not really meaningful anymore, right? I mean, so.
Periphery, as if, oh God, well that.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about periphery and core because there's whole denial that China's part of the core, which seems ludicrous. So
before we get into the weeds or the weeds of these things, just to circle back a little bit to the pre-2016 left.
All right. Yeah, keep us focused, Amo.
Yes. Yes.
So what did you see as the trends then? You were much younger than me and less cynical.
Yes. At the time, I think I can give you a fair go.
Well, you're
now,
still much younger than me. I don't know if you're less cynical.
No. I'm still. It doesn't change.
Actually, the funny thing is, you said that my cynicism seems weaker now than it used to be. But I don't know if that's because you have adopted a lot of my cynicism and thus it doesn't seem as bad, or if I've actually changed. So.
I'm inclined to say a bit of both. I suppose for a while, there was a lot of, at least I'm thinking of the period from 2014 to 2016, sort of the first 2 years of SR, there was a lot of just like reassertion of, you know, Marxism is existing and, you know, Marxist solutions as being like interesting and literature being published on utopianism. And this is, you know, the sort of first flowerings of Jacobin. But at this point, there aren't these deep divides about, you know, reformism versus, you know, revolution. I shouldn't put it that way, but you know what I mean about, you know, whether you should support Corbyn or you should support Bernie, and whether electoralism is the way to go. You know, these conversations, while always there, were kind of subordinate to the main theme, which is kind of like, look, we're getting back in the spotlight and this is a thing to do again. And, you know, since 2016, that has been much less the case. And we've had this kind of, even on outside our sect of the left, we've had this kind of upsurge in like tactical conversation. And here I'm in describing these changes, I'm not talking about the two of us or the people we dialogue with. I'm talking about the kind of the people who we're ostensibly talking to. Right, the broader left milieu. In some sense, I think we were always like the conversations that we have been having in terms of like, you know, there's a conversation that the two of us have been having, which is kind of broad ranging and intellectual and cultural historical. But the conversation that you've been having with people around you seems to me to be like best classified as like Marxological and like strategic.
Right. Marxological, strategic, and tactical. And frankly, one of the things I worry about is we have jumped to tactics. Since 2016, there seems to be a fundamental content for actually working out the fundamentals of what we really mean. And that's across the board. Like, people don't like political economy. They don't like talking about value theory because, like, admittedly, no one fights and dies for value theory, right? I get it. But, like, do we really know what we're fighting for, and do we actually agree? And I mean, I think the clear answer is no.
No.
We don't.
Right. So on the broader left, there's this kind of like, I don't know how to put it. I wouldn't call it complacency. It's continuing incoherence, you know, creative incoherence and kind of wild sort of ambulance chasing to various trends.
Oh God. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and on our side, there's on our section of the broader left, there is this kind of like, as I said, sort of Marxology, focus on various local problems, You know, when you keep talking about these isms, you know, Leninism, you know, and initially you get the impression, and I did, that there are these like big, deep doctrinal theoretical disagreements.
No, right? Half of this is style, frankly.
Yeah, and the tactics. It's not, you know, Leninism versus MLM versus Leninism is not a dispute about value theory.
No.
Right.
It's not a dispute about value theory. It's not even a dispute about transitional forms. It's not a dispute about the nature of bourgeois revolutions or anything like that. And that's been true for a while. If you look at the 70s, like the Trotskyist disputes, they were always like fixed up in like the nature of the Soviet Union, which they were all wrong about, by the way.
Yes. Yes.
McNair points that out. Not a single one. If you look at their predictions on what would happen, not a single one of them were right. Although apparently the Sparts and the Marcionites, who disagree on everything else, were the closest right. to what actually right. happened.
Maybe here's a way of posing a question that would be more helpful for us to pass the developments in this period. Like, you know, the kind of founding premise of a bunch of activity, not just you and I, but all of us, is that, like, for a bunch of, you know, from the 1970s onwards, you know, people dismissed Marxism in the academy and so on and so forth. And they were wrong, or they were hoodwinked, or something, like whatever story you want to give of that. And now we're reclaiming or recovering something and kind of making up for lost time, right? This was a story that all of us told ourselves. I would have agreed with this. You would have agreed with this. Doug agrees with this. Everyone agrees with this. That, you know, people kind of had this knee-jerk dismissal of the history of Marxist theory for what we thought, and I still think, are not very good reasons, and we were kind of correcting that. Right.
And honestly, the conservative responses, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, were better than the liberal ones.
Yes, although as you probably read, I'm skeptical about the extent to which they're like well-founded, deeply conservative, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh yeah. But like I think about someone like Marshall Poe, who's not a conservative politically so much, but he is a conservative intellectually.
Right.
He's in that Francis Fukuyama tradition, kind of.
Right.
And they seem to always take Marxism more seriously than everybody else. Like, since it was an enemy, you know, but our friends until very recently. I mean, like, you think about the Keynesian dismissals of Marxism, a lot of them are a joke.
Yes. And we were right about that. We were right that people weren't giving weren't giving good reasons for ignoring what was obviously this incredibly important historical tradition.
Like how can, like, that? You remember that last chapter of the Stephen King book?
Yes.
Where he basically, like, Marx doesn't factor in machines into value production. That's just not true.
Right.
Like, it's just it's a ridiculous assertion.
But I feel like the stupidity of recent Marx criticism has kind of, like, obscured why Marxism really fell away and why a whole generation of people felt inclined to dismiss it or qualify their attachment to it.
Well, the Soviet Union failed, for one thing. Like, right. That's like the big fucking elephant in the room, right? I mean, like,
right.
And what the China has done to maintain itself is very hard to, I mean, you can take the 150-foot developmentalist view, but it's very hard to say that it is what it's done is clearly Marxist, since, like, there's private property and stuff. And even at the height of so-called state capitalism in the Soviet Union, there was not that.
Right. So the question I guess I'm trying to ask is, what do we know that, Irving Kristol didn't know, right? And what do we know by Irving Kristol? I'm kind of using that as an emblem for, you
know. Like, why aren't we neoconservatives?
No, well, not quite that. I mean, like, more generally, you know, it doesn't have to be just Marxist and neocon. More generally, there was this, like, turn away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even for people who remain Marxist, from the set of the characteristic claims.
Like the postmodernists and the post-Marxists too. I mean, like,
right.
Like, all those people have kind of fallen out of, well, I say they fall out of favor, and then I go to a graduate conference in English, and then I, like, am reminded that they're not as out of favor as I think.
Well, you say that, but the big trend, and I'm literally sitting here, you know, two meters away from the Gayatri Spivak's complaint department, you know, you say that, but the big fashion now amongst, you know, graduate students in the humanities is that, you know, Marx is back, and, you know, or in fact, it has been now for about 10 years.
Right. You know, the two trends I remember, I was at a narratology conference almost 10 years ago, right? That was back when I was an academic. And it was all either like, we're going to use Evo Psych to justify narrative theory, or we're going to use Badu and maybe Lacan, but we're going to make Lacan a Marxist somehow. Is, you know, but the thing is, though, it Marx is back, but it's not Marx.
That's what I was trying to say, right? That like we thought in starting SR and doing in the Platypus and all the projects since Occupy that we had like somehow, you know, erased certain criticisms in the past or kind of solved something. That's like predicates but all the projects that you and I have entered into, that like we're going back to this tradition which was left behind unnecessarily.
We were going to pick up. Like, my thoughts is, if anyone's ever read the Russell Jacoby book, Dialectic of the Feet, we were going to pick up, you know, what got blown up for me in, like, 1922.
Right, right. I think the sort of ghost staggered on until 1965 or something, and then it finally dropped dead.
Ironically, the New Left and the return of the anti-revisionist movements was a sign of a certain kind of Marxism dying. Just like Occupy was a sign of a certain kind of anarchism done.
Right. And so the question to ask is, what have we done, you, I, the people we talk to, the people we read, to revivify the corpse? What have we actually done in the past 10 years?
Oh, nothing.
Well, I mean, that's not quite. We've definitely, you know, there's a lot of smart economic and sociological claims that you can find in Marx that we've defended, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's fair to say. But you know, I mean, you know, there's obviously not all the you and I obviously wouldn't dismiss all the, you know, the huge mountain of literature that has come out, you know, arguing for a Marxist
position
in this, you know.
But clarifying the theoretical questions and clarifying the tactical questions and actually doing something, those are actually three very separate things.
Right.
I feel like we've made some headway on theoretical clarification. Although I have to be honest with you, the more I dig in and the more I know, the less I'm sure that we really have.
Well, that was my point. I mean, I'm sort of wary of your kind of putting all the fault on the side of action. So I was just the question that I was trying to pose was purely theoretical. How much have we really saved, even theoretically?
Well, I mean, for example, I was having this discussion today on various interpretations of Marxism and how credit/debt money and commodity money, which are crucial to Marx. Commodity money is Capital Volume 1. It's really Capital Volume 2.
Right.
And credit money is really a major part of Capital Volume 3. Does modern fiat currency actually fit into credit money? Neoclassicals, you know, even though they disagree with Marx on value, would actually agree kind of on credit money.
Yes.
And MMT doesn't, right? Although they're a little weird about that. So
yeah. I mean, MMT at this stage, I think, is best seen as a kind of empty legal claim that as a matter of pure legality, the bourgeois state has the ability to do X, Y, and Z.
Well, I mean, it is sort of the ultimate political determinism, but it doesn't look like it, right? Because it looks like it's an economic claim. But it basically says all matters of value are matters of currency, and all matters of currency are matters of actual political power.
Right.
Ipso facto.
But not even political power, right? Like state fiat.
Yeah.
Right?
The political power to issue state fiat.
Yes.
Which leads to stuff like power law of value and stuff like that.
Yeah. But of course the analysis of power is like very, very,
it's vague as fuck.
Vague as fuck. Right?
Yeah. I mean, like and often they try to argue that this is a net good that we could use for social progressivism, but most of their best examples are like colonial governments who are mandating debt. So,
right. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, we can decide how much we want to relitigate that stuff. But
No. I just want people to understand like what we're talking about. So like when I sit down to figure out if, for example, are the Mandelites correct for the disciples of Ernst Mandel that commodity money, a la metallic money, is really super important to understanding Marx? which leads to this whole like modern Trotskyist Goldbug tendency, versus like people who have some sort of fiat currency capitulation. And we actually sit down and try to do math and predictions off this. I'll be honest with you, none of it ever comes out right. Like, and I don't know if it's because we don't know how to do the math, or if the totality of calculations belong to any one person, or, you know, whatever. But it is not confidence making, let me put it that way.
And that was the, I mean, so we do, so here's what we have done, I think, on the left, which is over the past 10 years, there is a certain way in which, like, we have pierced through, like, the sort of knee-jerk, pro-free market, anti-socialist rhetoric that there was in the popular media. People used to believe that much more 10 years ago, much less, much fewer people do now.
So maybe I would give you a second, because I think I agree with you, because what I wanted to break down, I've been working with Lexi K from Swampside Chats on a reconceptualization of the spectrum of political responses. But we needed to not just start, because there's a tendency to start with your own weird ass micro stuff and forget that, like, even though Marxism's had a comeback, we're still not the majority of anything. Like,
right.
Like, you know, we're at most like 5% of the population, maybe like 50% of the population no longer thinks we're insane, but like actual diehard doctrinaire Marxists, you know, there's still not that many. I mean, even when you really join in the organizations, I mean, most people are skeptical on something. So would you like to, you showed me something where you kind of came up with a spectrum of the responses to this and what you see the problems is. Would you like to like conceptualize one, and then I'll comment once you get through with each part of the spectrum?
Sure. So this was less a kind of an account of the political spectrum, you know, in the traditional sense. And as you said, more an account of responses to the financial crisis as I saw them, right? So I roughly grouped them in, I mean, the sort of three categories and their subdivisions within those categories, right? So there's the sort of the overwhelmingly dominant response I see as like nostalgic centrism of various kinds. Or maybe centrism is not helpful here. Let's say nostalgia of various kinds. So there's like political nostalgia, which is, you know, some people might see this as a sort of liberal response, nostalgia for the political institutions of pre-1970s the West, or political norms of that period, right? So that's one kind of response to the crisis, that like, oh, well, the reason we're in this mess is because, you know, people aren't bipartisan enough and people don't trust politicians enough, et cetera, you know, social trust has eroded, et cetera, right? That's like one category of response. This you see, I don't find it helpful to call it centrist, but the people who would subscribe to this would be people who call it, who you could call centrist, right? So that's one kind of category. Another kind of category is more what you would call social democratic, which is nostalgia for the economic institutions of pre-1970s, the West again, right? So nostalgia for a kind of corporatism. Big labor and big labor, big corporations, and big government, global institutions which ensure that, you know, their countries don't run big current account deficits and surpluses, you know, kind of global coordinated Keynesianism, you know, back to the 1940s again,
which is still a centrist response, really. But
yes, and when you lay this out, I would say these two ideas that I laid out constitute like 90% of the intellectual response to the to these,
And also clearly the policy responses too. I mean, like you call the second response, you know, like a tendency towards something like social democracy, right? You see that in the MMTers and then, you know, Galbraith Jr. and Dean Baker, Krugman, Stiglitz, Westbrot. But you also see it, frankly, in Jacobin and Sinclair. And Sankora, I mean, I'll be honest with you. If you look at as an issue of Mother Jones, and you look at an issue of Jacobin, and it's harder and harder to tell their actual content apart.
Right. There are strategic and tactical differences. So the Jacobin people will say, "Well, you aren't going to get these reforms without a militant labor movement," right? Like that's their line.
They still think it's pretty much going to come from the Democratic Party.
Yes, I mean, but even if they, like, so. you could imagine a position which people have, and you know, it sort of makes sense that people would have this position where, you know, you could think that the Democrats kind of don't, you could have a sort of like left, let's say, sort of radical syndicalist position on which, you know, militant trade unions outside the Democratic Party or maybe a third party brings in these changes, right? But even that position would still be classed in this sort of economic nostalgia space.
Well, because
I'm thinking of like Seth Ackerman, right?
Yeah, and Seth Ackerman, in some ways Corbynism too, frankly, because it seems to be based on an industrial economy that Britain just doesn't have.
And actually, I try to think hard about like where even people on the far left differ from this, and I have no idea, honestly. I have no idea.
It does seem tactical, honestly, because a lot of them think it's a lot of state spending. A lot of them, like one thing, I had a recent argument where somebody's like, we'll need value added or income taxes in socialism. And I was like, we're not supposed to be producing value. And so, like.
Yeah. Like, and I mean, to be honest with you, Derek, a lot of people could hear people like you and Ross Wolf, and, you know, Ross disagrees with this kind of like nation state socialism. A lot of people would see your disagreement with, you know, creating these social democratic institutions as also being tactical, right? As being like, oh, you can't do this, you know, the center of power through which you achieve the Keynesian consensus or something like that can't be the nation state because the nation state is capitalist and, you know, capital flight and all that, right? So the capital flight objections, which are usually like the thing that you use to differentiate social democracy from non-social democracy, right? It's like even those could be seen as like political differences.
Right. I think there are actual substantive differences. One of the things that it comes down to is while I do think there are bourgeois things in whatever the next state of society is, and this differs me from, say, like Marxist humanist or whatever. Although I don't, my complaints with social democracy are deeper than that. It's not just that the nation state is capitalist. And actually, I'm not sure the nation state is always capitalist.
Right.
It's always liberal.
Right.
So,
but you can see how if you listen to Derek on Syriza, that's the kind of main thrust you can get out of it. That like,
right.
Oh, capital flight is the main problem. You can't have a currency on your own. Autarky is bad. Like all those things are true, but I just mean if you heard those, you would think that there was this tactical disagreement.
Like the autarky is good versus autarky is bad issue.
Right.
Yeah.
And the answer should be, you know, a social democrat can hear that and say, yeah, that's right. That means, you know, we should try to take power in a number of different countries at once. And that'll be harder, but, you know, all I want to say is that capital flight is not the beginning and end of our problems here.
No.
Right?
Definitely.
That can't be the only disagreement.
The other disagreements that you have right now that are actually formal, not substantive, believe it or not, are to democracy versus party rule.
Right.
Well, I mean, those can make a big difference in quality of life, but like even Marx, I think there's notes in the economic manuscripts where Marx says that, you know, what he wants could come either from democracy or autarky or, you know.
Right.
Regardless, and his dictatorship of the proletariat, as he seemed to view it, seemed to be a class democratic dictatorship.
Right.
So,
just to be clear, though, I'm not saying that there aren't any like theoretical or doctrinal differences between the left and social democrats. I'm just saying that these differences haven't shown up in like public responses to the crisis.
No. Well, I mean, you know, for people who have really strong critiques of social democracy, and yet their model for what, you know, a transitional society for socialism would be is the Chinese state. I actually don't get their argument.
Right.
Like, is it just because one is Western and one is not Western? I mean, like, is that really the issue? It's because one is quote-unquote core and the other isn't quote-unquote core, even though it's the second largest manufacturing power on Earth? But like, what's the issue there?
Yeah, exactly. And if it's not China, then, you know, then the thing that you hear, you know, when you go on left-wing websites and you'd be like, okay, well, what is the big difference? You know, the thing that gets mentioned again and again and again is capital flight, right?
Right.
But the whole point is that capital flight argument has limitations because the social democrats can take that on, right? Like, listen to Navarra. All they talk about is capital flight. You know, McDonald has a plan about capital flight. Let's talk about capital flight. You know, what about Mitterrand in the 80s, etc.? You know. And I was stunned by this at the beginning. I was like, how can you, you know, surely capital flight plus social democracy equals does not compute, right? Because I had been taught by you guys that, like, capital flight is like the death knell for social democracy, right? But not in practice. In practice, they can treat it as like a strategic hangover. At least, I mean, intellectually, this is all.
Yeah, but the difference is the goal too. This is
like
this is where you guys, you guys being like people who don't really pay attention, missed is like I don't. There's not a society on Earth that doesn't have that is developed economically that doesn't have majority capitalist characteristics.
Yes.
Not a single one.
Yes.
China is weird and in ways that make it hard for me to say it's clearly capitalist, but it still has the most billionaires on Earth, and there's private ownership of most of its social surplus, even if 60% of the businesses are owned by the state technically.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah, no, there are for sure big differences. I'm absolutely not arguing that social democrats are the same as communists. It's just that in terms of, you know, when the rubber hits the road in public conversation, these differences don't assert themselves, is all I'm saying.
Well, because they're based, like, there is more primary differences. This is what we kind of get back to the beginning. Like, what you think value is, even though it's not sexy, really does fucking matter for what you think what you think this economy is going to look like.
Right.
Like, I've been discussing labor tokens, for example, for years as a transitional form. In some ways, it seems irrelevant now because we can do a lot of the stuff with computers we couldn't have.
Right.
But, like, there are elements of labor tokens that recapitulate the problems of currency and capitalism.
Yes.
There are elements of it that don't. But some of the elements of it that don't make me afraid that it wouldn't work.
Yes.
That it would be inherently deflationary, or like that the amount of political control of it is actually overstated, that it would actually still, even though labor tokens are not supposed to be transferable, that it would lead to the creation of black markets. And so, and the dispute there, again, that's not a dispute just tactically, it's a dispute on what you think the primary elements of capitalism are.
Right.
If you think, for example, if you're one of those people who thinks that the primary cause of capitalism is markets, one, you must think that everything historically ever is capitalism. And two, like, what kind of transitional form could you possibly have without total like rationing, which is what like Bordiga and stuff actually advocated, was complete and utter rationing of every.
That strikes me as a disaster.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it hasn't historically worked out very well. No.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so I'm happy to grant that there's this like deep important value theoretic difference. All I'd say was that I wouldn't count that difference as a difference in terms of a response to the crisis.
Well, what the hell would be a difference in response to the crisis?
I guess I was thinking about it in terms of a program.
Okay, but what would a program mean? Because here's something that I'm absolutely insistent on. You cannot make a maximalist program. That's impossible. It would be
right.
In so much that it isn't impossible, you are like, I had this new atheist on my wall, like complaining about, what do you mean the social scientific versus utopian? Isn't it scientific versus religious? I was like, God, you're dumb. But also in a very real sense, the issue there is the utopian socialist ideal was like, you could come up with a total program for the final stage and like, nothing in history worked that way. So, like, if we came up with an immediate program for the crisis, what would it be? And also programs are tactical as well as strategic.
Yeah.
So like, I'm not sure that it would actually meet your distinction.
So in that case, then, I guess what I was looking at was, you know, what have people on the non-social democratic left been saying since let's say 2008?
Well, I think it's actually been radically different between 2008 and 2016 and 2016 to now, for one thing.
Yes. And I think the reason that I downplayed the differences, or at least I downplayed the kind of like programmatic differences, was because a lot of the stuff that I was hearing was, yeah, some of the stuff that the Social Democrats say is good, but it has to be combined with like the right kind of militant organization, where that can be, I don't know, anything from a kind of party or, you know, a sort of commune or,
Right. So the distinction there is not programmatic, but formal, right? So
yes.
So it's that you have to have the right form for whatever necessary, like historically necessary reason. And, you know, I also have wondered if that's just an assumption, like, yes. like just cause we say it has to be true because that's really where our distinction is. Right.
Right. And our, that point gets its power from the fact that the Social Democrats keep failing. Right. And right. So the reason people like this formal point is because it seems to say, it doesn't require you to revise a lot of your assumptions about either program or theory. It just, you know, just change your political form.
So the issue is political militancy.
Right. A huge amount of the debates you've been talking about, you know, Marxist-Leninist versus Leninist and Maoist and so on, to me fall in this formal category.
Well, there are other differences. So, for example, yes. The Leninist versus Marxist-Leninist versus Maoist actually also is about which classes you can tend to be adjacent enough to the proletariat to be included.
Yes. Yes.
What kinds of petty bourgeois count? How do you structure the classes after a revolution? And I say that because some of these questions we've forgotten were answered and not yes. satisfactorily. I mean, like, for a while in China, there was literally a class origins caste system.
Right.
Like, you know, which seems nutty.
Right.
Like, if class is based off what you do and you've supposedly abolished capitalism, or at least you're phasing it out, why do you need an origins caste system? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
But to me, whatever position you take, either on the formal question or on this, you know, where is the proletariat question, those two questions strike me as like subordinate to this bigger question, which you talked about earlier, which is the value theoretic question, right? About, you know, the tyranny of the value form and how you abolish. Well, sorry, I don't want to use value form because I don't know whether value VFT is really bad and tainted, but, you know.
What do you think okay. Not on VFT. My issue with you on that is actually a little more complicated. I actually don't think it's just one question. And this actually puts me in a radically different position than some of the people who are my allies. So, yes. For example, I do take Eric Olin Wright to be correct, that you have to you have to separate oppression from exploitation, which Marxists have classically done.
Yes.
For example, imperialism is both oppression and exploitation, right? It's not yes. just exploitation. That's one of its distinctions. Exploitation is economic, oppression is political, and it's direct, although it also can be social, but it's direct. Like, it's yes. I'm beating the shit out of you, literally. Exploitation is subtle. I also yes. like to add the third category that muddles up Marxist politics a lot, and this is from Eric Olin Wright, but it's something that right-wingers and, like, Weberians pick up on, and that is social domination. Like, why do you hate your boss more than your owner? Your boss is actually usually technically a proletariat, your immediate boss. I mean, which is crazy to think about, right? But, they're wage earners, too. And depending on how you define, you know, working class and proletariat, they're still kind of in the category. So what do you do about that? And then there's the third thing that hasn't been dealt with. And I'll credit Donald Parkinson for putting this out, is, like, Marx didn't think intellectual labor being privatized was possible.
Yes. This is are you talking about like the general intellect stuff?
Yeah. He didn't see the general intellect being privatized.
Yes.
Through monopoly capital. Like that development had not happened yet.
Yeah.
And while it's still true that all the countries with dominant monopoly capital and intellectual property are also the countries that are the biggest producers of
yes.
material goods. And like, and that, yes. that's still true and can't be ignored. And a lot of people do the United States is still the second largest producer on earth. It just isn't, it isn't as dominant as a spending power goes. And that does have to do with intellectual property. But those three questions are substantive, like in a very
yes.
real way. Like, so one yes. is value form theoretic, but the others are more substantive too. I think you really have to, because you could agree on value form theory and still differ because of those other two questions, I think. Because a lot of Leninists, for example, don't think domination is a problem if exploitation and oppression is removed.
Right, right.
They just don't. They don't see it. They think it'll be democratic. Like, democratic domination is okay.
And that obviously has horrible consequences.
I mean, it's the thing that anarchists would always throw at Marxists that I think kind of sort of sticks. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as a, you know, it's one of the, one of the key themes of the Frankfurt School, mm-hmm. I'd say. You know, that's the Weberian heritage, which we tried to emphasize so much.
Right. I mean, because there's a tendency to make the Adorno period of Frankfurt School more Marxist and also more consistent than it was, because Adorno and Marcuse barely agreed on anything. Marcuse did agree more and more with Adorno as he got older, but like in the 60s, they were almost diametrically opposed.
Right.
But the other thing is, you and I both come out of this, and a lot of people hate the Frankfurt School for reasons that it make it, like, if you take Adorno too seriously, it makes the idea of, like, well, I mean, it does, his focus on domination to the extent that he does makes social liberation seem impossible.
But also, it's just weird. I mean, I'm not even sure whether the central concept ends up being domination. I think it's just, like, weird, like, combination of, you know, the abstraction of the value form and how that, like, that now, like, becomes infused with stuff that was, like, bits of exploitation, bits of domination. I don't know what the irrationality of capitalist society as a whole is, other than that it's totalizing and it's bad in later Adorno.
Right. And you know, reason produces the dream of unreason.
Yes.
But which seems both true, but, like, actually vague as fuck. Like, the dialectic of enlightenment seems, like, transparently true, but if you actually try to get, like, causal mechanisms out of it, good luck.
Yeah, so I don't disagree with you that all these questions, at least I think we've laid out about five or six by now, that represent substantive differences between a left grouping and a social democratic grouping.
Right. Between left groupings and left groupings. For example, the oppression / domination question is a difference between intersectional, adjacent, and non-intersectional Marxists. Because the intersectional, adjacent Marxists, social reproduction theorists, people who like, believe it or not, compared to a lot of the social democrats, as much as I have the strong critiques of identity politics, I don't go as far as they do.
Yes.
Like, nor am I, frankly, deluded enough to believe that all racial social problems would just magically go away with capitalism.
Yes, but if you let's say we take everything you said on board, and I'm certainly inclined to, the kind of what would be, I think that by the end of this, a sort of useful collective description for people on the left is that, you know, okay, there are a bunch of people who think that the problem can't just be solved by going back to another set of institutions. They believe the problem is more structural to, you know, this thing called a mode of production, which is, you know, underlies a bunch of more shallow features of social life, right?
Most people on the left, like, say that, and they believe it, I think, but then what they actually talk about doesn't go that way.
Right. So you're bringing up, I was gonna grant that and say, even that admission doesn't necessarily get us that far, right?
Even now you
stopped me even before where I was gonna go, that, like, a lot of people don't even say that. I was gonna say, let's grant that, and even, you know, people who believe there is something structurally wrong with the mode of production, to me, it doesn't really describe like a collective worry more than a political.
And honestly, it applies to a lot of right wingers too, frankly.
Exactly.
Why are right wing anti-capitalists fundamentally different from Marxists? And what's interesting is Marxists, I have a tendency to say, like, fascists, for example, are just capitalists, right? And that it's just bourgeois. It's just bourgeois class consciousness or whatever. That's bullshit. It's a fucking lie.
Yes.
Like, for one, if you look at the economic policies of fascists, with the exception of Hitlerism, which is a little different, they were fucking social democrats. Just for, like, and a lot of the left comms aren't wrong about historically, a lot of their early membership was social democratic or anarchist or syndicalist.
Right.
Like, they've moved away from that in power, but then so has everybody else in power. So, like I'm not...
And the key thing that differentiated us from them, which was, you know, the progressive movement of history and, you know, all that, all the good sort of positive vision, that's the thing that's fallen away.
Right, yeah. Like, what separates us from them is a hatred of nationalism and a view of progressivism, although... Progressivism kind of didn't survive post-Marxism. So you have these questions, but even if you get something like clarification on them, right now it's very hard to tell where we are in relationship to them. And it's also, I mean, also one of the things that you and I both notice is how the more Marxist we get, you know, I remember like Zizek's whole like, well, no one talks about Lenin, everybody talks about Marx, but that's not true.
Yeah.
I like you, in any given day, when everyone I'm talking to Marxists, everybody fucking talks about Lenin. Nobody talks about Marx. I think one is Marx's actual political record's harder to make sense of. Because his writings and his life don't entirely mesh up, actually. Two, it's unclear how much Engels and Marx are the same person. The Leninists seem to think that they're one-to-one. A lot of left communists seem to think that there's no relationship whatsoever. And I tend to be like, they agreed on a lot. But I don't think you can say that Marx and Engels really, like Engels was just like Marx's stooge or whatever. They actually did have independent thoughts. So,
right.
The third question is, how relevant is all this to anything now?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, in some ways, it's still not clear to me that we're dealing with the same, I mean, like, oh, people are going to get mad at this. I think in the main, we're dealing with the same form of capitalism, but I'm not entirely sure, because there is the elephant in the room that Marxists, one of the reasons why I think value theory has fallen away as a debate, currency is different. We're not quite sure how. It is unclear if modern currency is purely credit currency, if it's a proxy for a commodity, if it's purely fiat. It, like, try to figure that out. It's not easy.
Yeah, but the problem isn't just currency, right? The problem is, I feel like you can just even just take the all the different distinctions and separations you made. Mm-hmm. Between different questions that Marxists conflate, different questions that you can have different positions on, which determine whether you're on the left, like the, you know, that differentiate you from social democrats. I submit that even once you make those distinctions, you begin to realize that you no longer have anything like the Marxism evolved. What you have is a set of inherited problems.
I unfortunately, I agree. And I actually think that's part of why Leninism, of its various varieties, has become popular. It's because Leninism was an attempt to deal with the inherited problems and also say they weren't.
Right.
Right.
And so I'm a bit wary of the kind of constant invocation of value theory as an attempt to resurrect something old. I am not wary of value theory. That's fine. That's totally fine.
But who actually does that outside of like some circles around me? Like, you don't see that a lot.
No. I was talking about who I was talking about.
Right, right. But like you don't see that a lot around in like Marxist activist circles. What you see there is an avoidance of it entirely.
Right. And there we get really back into the tactical and strategic,
right.
You know.
So you have one group of people who thinks we can just value theory our way to pure Marx. And once we pure Marx ourselves, I guess revolution or something. And right. I mean, they literally do see this as a thinking problem, and this is what I call Marxo-Gnosticism. Like, it's weird for people who believe it's the claim to be materialist, but I also don't know what their politics actually ends up being. Like you could hold almost any political position in the short run and believe that.
Right. You know, and I keep talking about, you know, the sort of Marxism of old, and no, we don't have Marxism of old. The Marxism of old, it's crucial to realize, was not just a set of empirical, sociological, and economic claims, right? It was a way of looking at the world. I mean, I don't have the terminology to put this in, so I'm going to give my best first pass. It was a way of looking at the world and the nature of human beings in terms of a totality, which had important philosophical a priori components which were needed to interpret social reality, but were not themselves refutable by social reality. This is not a bad thing, I should hasten to say, right? A lot of people, particularly people, I suspect some people in circles around you, I'll leave that open. A lot of people think that any invocation of some non-empirical element is heresy, you know. But what happened to the critique of positivism? Why the hell is this reactionary stuff returning on the left?
The whole like Marxist positivist stuff.
Yeah, one of the core claims of Marxism is, you know, the central way of understanding human subjectivity is in terms of a dialectical relationship between human capacities and nature. Mm-hmm. That is not an empirical claim. And that's fine. That's really...
Marx knew that. So, like...
Yeah, that is not a claim about the economy. That is a claim about, you know, being society as a whole. It's like a first philosophy claim.
Right.
It's, you know, it's like Thales, being as water. That's what we've got.
Remember first or second episode when I said Marxism is not just an economic theory, it is a theory of history.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely crucial.
And it's a theory of history, like history, it's not just a history as a specific science, right? It's history as, you know, being, as a human life as a whole.
It is a theory of the way humans work. It is a
yes.
It is a theory of human development, if you really want to get like technical.
But all I mean is, you say the word human development and American social scientists will hear a particular thing.
Right. They'll hear, I don't know, child psychology or something, but
yeah,
that's also been my problem with Marxism that I've said for years, is because that theory doesn't have a theory of mind clearly stated in it.
Right.
Right.
Like Marx does believe in, like he believes in species being, which in our parlance means he believes in something like human nature. But the species being is heavily modified by its historical conditions so much that you can't say what it is.
Yes.
And that actually precludes a clear theory of mind, like of the individual subjectivity. And Marx actually remarks that the individual subjectivity is important, but since history is made in aggregate, that's what he's going to focus on. Like,
and the reason it's so structurally difficult to get a theory of mind is that the occupant of like the place of mind is, you know, human capacities to produce.
Right.
But no.
Because human capacities to produce is for something else. Like, this is where that's a misreading. Production is how we reorganize ourselves to reproduce ourselves. But we have a social, we have a natural being. Marx does have a rudiments of human nature. You get this from his discussions of like dogs, where he talks about if you want to study dogs, you have to study dogs in their natural environment. You find out what dog being is. The thing is, he's actually really prescient, for example, about our studies of dogs and wolves, where we made a lot of bad assumptions about their social order because we studied them in captivity and assumed it was the same. And that's not actually true, apparently. Well, you know, human beings are the same way. Our being is socially mediated. Marx is actually really prescient on this in ways that's like really only being figured out now. But it does preclude, because Marx says history is made in aggregate, not in individuals. He's not as concerned with great men.
Right.
He doesn't come up with a clear theory, or he doesn't state a clear theory of the individual mind, even though he does not think people are purely the product of their collective class. It's like, so class, for example, he doesn't talk about collectivities. He talks about aggregates. Which is a different thing, actually. And a lot of the way modern Marxists have interpreted, and particularly in the United States, is through Cold War misreadings that they've just decided were correct. Like, you know, the whole collectivism versus individualism. Well, that's dumb. Like, for that, that's like an unsublatable dialectic. And it's also not how people work. Like, you know, you don't learn language individually.
Right.
You know? But you also, like, aren't, like... Like Marx knew damn well that for example, the concept of proletarianization makes no sense if you think class consciousness is totally predicated on the social class that you happen to be in at any given time. But like all this stuff is actually really vague because like class consciousness, for example, would hint at a theory of mind, but that theory of mind is not articulated.
Right. All I was saying when I mentioned the capacity to produce stuff is that, you know, in the idealist tradition, in the Hegelian idealist tradition that Marx is invoking, like mind is thought of in terms of like a self-developing, self-determining process.
Right. And a self-developing, self-determining process that is probably coming out of the emergence of God. Right.
Yes. Like, although question mark, question.
Yeah. Question mark, because Hegel's vague as fuck.
Yes. Right.
But almost certainly out of God. So
all I was saying in the case of Marx was that. The thing that occupies that mind space in the Marxian framework is not mind. It is productive development or something.
Right. But he still thinks that individual minds are important. He just doesn't really clarify how they work.
Right. And the point is he can't draw on his Hegelian tools, right?
Exactly. That's actually a very good insight. His Hegelian, you know, tools in that theology won't work for him because he doesn't assume that mind is self-developing. He presumes that mind emerges out of the relationships between people. Also, this is also something that people miss when we talk about materialism, because they think it's like vulgar materialism, like it's just, you know, random stochastic relationship between things.
No, it's not.
But it's not. It is the development between people and how they survive. So it's a social process.
Right. And development is best understood, I think, yeah, as you said, in like Aristotelian teleological language, that beings right. have certain powers and capacity, like, you know, the flower blooming or the acorn becoming an oak tree. That's the sort of model here.
Yeah, there is something missed in Marx that I think some people like Alastair MacIntyre, who ends up abandoning Marxism, but do pick up on, that there are weirdly, like, in some places he has Aristotelian assumptions. And he does mention Aristotle a lot in, like, Capital, for example.
Yes.
But,
yes.
And
just to repeat, that is not a priori a bad thing.
Right. Right. He, like, the Aristotelian assumptions are, like, what he doesn't, although he doesn't assume people have a singular purpose, which is also interesting. Because, for example, Marx thought that there are radical differences between nation states because of geography. Which yes. which leads to him being able to justify his bigotry against the English, for example.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir. Our ever faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.